And welcome to Foolproof Theology, the show where we like to talk about theology that is foolproof, uncut, conversations that are strong and well-aged. I'm your host, Chase Davis, and today I'm really excited about our guest today, who's a fellow pastor in Acts 29 with me, Dr. Paul Dean. Paul is the lead pastor of Soma Eastside Church, an Acts 29 church, and this is really what we're trying to do this season on this podcast. This is season 2, episode 3, and we're featuring Acts 29 pastors who have either worked and done PhD work or have completed PhD work. And what we're trying to do is just elevate the conversation on various topics related to life, to ministry, and doing a deep dive in some PhD work from pastors. He is also the planting pastor of Aletheia Community Church. That was in 2005. He and his wife, Catherine, have 4 kids, and he holds a PhD in American history from Washington State University. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'm so glad to have you here. Was that PhD in American history from Washington State, was that recent? When did you go after that?
I got both master's and PhD from Washington State, so that was 99 that I began that, and then finished the coursework in 2004, but didn't finish my dissertation until 2011.
Oh, nice.
So I made the great choice to plant a church while finishing my dissertation, and that stretched it out a bit.
It tends to do that. We planted and I got my MDiv and THM at the same time, and I don't recommend it. It's a chore.
No. Did anyone tell you not to do it as you were making that choice?
You know, I'm not sure that if anyone had told me, I probably just didn't hear them. You know, I was young enough to just go, I can do it.
Yeah. Yeah, you got this.
Yeah, totally. Oh, man. Well, I want to hear more about your PhD. You were kind of off the top. That's what I like to do on the show. That typically leads us down some various rabbit trails where we can get into some of your work as a pastor and how that plays into your ministry. I guess one of the first questions I have was getting a PhD, was going after that, was that something you always wanted to do?
I think so. I thought maybe it would be a law degree early on. When I was growing up, I really enjoyed discussions, or as other people refer to them in a negative way, arguments, and loved fighting for things that I believed in. And so lawyer seemed like the practical application of that, but became a Christian at 16, and God very quickly changed that trajectory to pastor. And I thought that I would study theology and then get a PhD in church history. But I had a horrific church experience in the middle of seminary.
Oh, wow.
And I just switched streams, really not without, I didn't take time to pray about it. I just was done.
Sure.
Like, if this is what pastoring is all about, I'm out. And my second choice was historian, and so I applied, was accepted at Washington State, and there I went. But I come from a family of academics. My father has a PhD. My father-in-law has a PhD. My mother-in-law has a PhD. And so it's definitely, people have understanding for being in school too long in my family.
That's great. And yeah, it kind of had a lineage to pull from when things got tough, and you could see that it was possible, even though it took almost 12 years, it sounds like, to finish that that dissertation.
Yeah. Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah, I see Sam Smith saying hello from Facebook. Hi, Sam.
Yeah. I don't want to ask you to share anything that you don't want to share, but it sounds like you had a pretty tough church experience that kind of led you to take a more academic pursuit. You know, if there's a way you can summarize that without going into too many details you don't want to share, can you share a little bit about that experience that kind of led you away from ministry for a season?
Yeah, I guess I could. It's maybe something you laugh about now, but you know that each tribe in Christianity kind of has their pet issues. And so if you step on one of those pet issues, you get hit pretty hard. And when you're young, you don't realize it as a quirk of that particular denomination. You just see it as wrong
yeah.
and hurtful. and which it was. So I just was on the wrong side of ironically speaking, on a foolproof theology show, on the wrong side of grape juice / wine discussion in a Baptist church. And they just very quickly uninvited me to be their youth pastor. And it really was shocking and fast and painful. And I don't think I had the maturity to handle it well. And so I just said, peace, I'm out. But God over time brought me back. It was a soft call that got louder and louder and louder as I was studying at Washington State.
That's awesome. Well, I'm so glad to hear that. You know, God's grace is so evident in that story, because so many people do get hurt, unfortunately, by the church, and that may not be their story just yet. You know, and so I'm really thankful for your journey and your persistence and faithfulness in that way. As far as a PhD, you got yours specifically in American history. What was it about American history specifically, either that you studied, and what really sparked your interest in that?
Well, my degree is in U.S. diplomatic history. That's my major field, and then minor fields in East Asia and Latin America. So it's a broad scope, but it works really well with diplomatic history as far as the interaction between those language groups and nations. But diplomacy, interactions between nations, for whatever reason, has always interested me. I dialed in on two specific areas. My undergrad is also in history, but dialed in on World War I, and then ironically, Ronald Reagan's administration in the 80s. And so the PhD, the thesis or the dissertation is on how non-government organizations affect U.S. foreign policy. And effectively, how did churches push back against Reagan's foreign policy during the 80s, specifically in Nicaragua? I think most people that lived through the area remember the Iran-Contra controversy, but the dissertation focused on that.
Okay, that's a lot that we could talk about that I want to hear more about.
I warned you, Chase. The two ways I've been trained. One is theology, so that means I'm long-winded. The second is history, which means I'm boring. So this could go bad quickly. So please interrupt if things start to drone on.
The good news is that this podcast is designed for someone like you. So okay. We're gonna have a good time. As far as you know, I didn't grow up in that time period. I was born in 86. So when I hear Iran-Contra, you know, I've looked on Wikipedia to try to understand, because it seems interesting. I mean, you've got multiple nations on multiple continents involved in something that has to do with America and Nicaragua. So is there a way that you could teach me what was that controversy all about?
The 20th century is primarily an ideological battle. As far as, you know, you get post World War II, most certainly, but I think even arguably you can throw World War II in the middle of that. But you've got ideological battles that cause incredible amount of death and destruction. And because it's ideological and because it's worldwide, you have all these little conflicts that really shouldn't have happened in any sort of sane universe. Vietnam, Cambodia, all sorts of places around Africa, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and Nicaragua. So Nicaragua, you had a communist, the communists elected, and that's pretty famous in 20th century. You have one election, and then after that, there's no more real elections. And the communists win, and the United States do not want another Cuba. And really, after Cuba, that dominates our foreign policy towards Latin America. Like, no more Cubas, because the politicians get blamed. They get labeled soft on communism, and they begin to worry about the dominoes beginning to fall.
Okay,
so they begin with overt resistance, supporting the Contras against the Sandinistas, who were elected in Nicaragua. And when Congress puts a hold on that, Reagan's lieutenants, specifically Oliver North, one of them, and just some crazy stuff that goes on, but they begin to sell arms to places like Iran through Saudi Arabia, through Israel, and take that money and support Contras in Nicaragua. There's been movies about it. They're not very good, but there's been movies about it, and it's just as crazy cowboy John Wayne, who's not very effective, type stuff. And it how I got involved was it was a beautiful example of how Christians can influence even influence the party that they would normally support through opposition. So if you think about churches that you've been a part of, a lot of them that I've been a part of have been very involved in Latin America through mission trips. Mm-hmm. And so, and then once churches are planted, once those relationships are established, they become very strong through letters, visits, etc. And some of those churches, as they were communicating with their sister churches in Nicaragua, would hear things like, you know, Jose and Maria just got killed. And, you know, the response is, killed by who? And, oh, American supported Contras. And they're And so there's a phone call, there's a letter to their congressman, and things start to move. Eventually, the Contra program is halted in the early 90s. And I think in large part by non-government organizations who just say enough is enough.
Wow. That's an incredible kind of deep dive into you said NGOs, but churches specifically, really having this connection. I grew up doing mission trips to Latin America, Mexico and Honduras. And that's the way God kind of stirred my heart for missions, the nations, and ministry. And so, yeah, that's a really, really interesting topic to me. Was most of the communication, like you mentioned, it was the 80s and 90s, was most of it via letters that people were communicating with churches down in Nicaragua hearing this information?
Yes, letters, visits. Those are the type of things that historians can examine. Phone calls are tough.
For sure.
But I think even still today, you get such a different view of things when you're on the ground. And so I think those visits were key. And then those visits, as you know, some of these visitors are witnessing attacks by Contras, they went home and spoke about it, organized it, and formed profound opposition to it, even though many of those Christians would have voted for Reagan and would have been generally supportive of his foreign policy.
For sure. One kind of curious thing, anytime you study history, there's always major players that kind of come to the forefront, names associated with movements. Was this something, when you studied it, was this something that was pretty grassroots, or was there a leader of this kind of, whether you call it pushback or criticism of the kind of Contra method, was there a Christian leader in that kind of pushback?
No, I think it was more grassroots, and it was an opportunity for there to be some bipartisan opposition. So the national leaders would have been Democrats.
Okay. Now you go get your PhD. You've been hurt by the church. You're working on this very fascinating, American history kind of snapshot. And then all of a sudden you decide to go back into ministry. What was that like for you?
Well, it starts with disillusionment, I think. maybe halfway through, I start to get just this slow but steady call back to ministry. And I got involved in my church in Pullman. And the pastor there, I'd known the pastor there for decades, really since I could since I could walk. My parents, when my dad taught at Washington State, that was the church they belonged to, same pastor. So it was a familiar setting, but I got involved in the church, and people responded really well to when I spoke, when I taught. And so that kind of the call got louder and louder. But I just kept pushing it away. One, I'd already had a bad experience. And two, I really wanted to teach. Mm-hmm. And so they finally gave me a class. I finally became an actual instructor at Washington State University and taught a class on U.S. history. The two things that I determined after that, well, three. The first one is I hated grading. I absolutely hate grading with a passion. And I see Brad Duncan saying hello. Hi, Brad. The second thing that I discovered is that whenever I spoke on a historical topic, it was natural for me to immediately make a personal ethical application.
Ah.
Like I was preaching a sermon and history was an illustration. And I just kept catching myself. And then third, after teaching, I just realized, okay, I could walk away from this. This is fascinating to me, but it's not compelling for a career. Gotcha. There's something else. And so Catherine and I, my wife Catherine, and I began to pray daily, God, what do you want for me? And it became evident that it was to be a pastor, not a professor. And it's funny. I remember one morning as I'm praying, and I can even describe the place that I'm at in my mind, but I remember praying about it, saying, God, you want me to be a pastor rather than a professor? I've failed at being a pastor before. Please make it clear, and I'll follow you closely on this. And I got an email half hour later from a fellow professor at Washington State University, and he said, hey, can I take you out for coffee? And I said, sure. And we met at the Bookie, which is the bookstore at Washington State University, sat down, and with my coffee, he walked up looking super uncomfortable. And I said, what's up, Bruce? And he said, just bear with me. He said, I've never done this before. And he sat down and he said, I was doing my devotions this morning, and God kind of brought this to mind that he wanted me to come and tell you should be a pastor, not a professor. And then, you know, I just kind of
wow
backs up. So there was moments like that were subtle. but I just kept praying about it. And then I eventually brought this list of answered prayers to my elders, and they looked it over and they prayed over for a month, and they came back and they said, we see the gifting in you, and we think you should pursue this. And so I went through a Acts 29 boot camp and passed the assessment and planted a church in Issaquah, Washington.
That's amazing. What a cool story. And I love how persistent you were in being receptive to kind of outside counsel as far as people, you know, speaking in, affirming your gifts, even the boot camp model back in the day, which is a little different than it is now. Just trying to seek some wisdom there. That's great.
Thank God.
Oh man. You mentioned that you almost had this need when you taught to almost make it into a fable, where there was a moral kind of lesson. Mm-hmm. You know, that's curious thinking about your PhD and your dissertation particularly. What is it you would hope that Christians or churches or just people in general maybe should take away from the research you did?
Mm. History is a great antidote to arrogance. I mean, that's a paraphrase of a Paul Johnson quote, but history is a wisdom degree. Mm. I mean, history is the study of cause and effect. And so if you understand what has caused bad things in the past, you can learn from them and you can grow from them. I love it how history makes you think. So I would hope that people would read history and see the book of Proverbs unfold and remember that we shouldn't be on the wrong side of the book of Proverbs.
Right.
We shouldn't be on the, you know, Proverbs often has, you know, contrasting paths or contrasting choices. And history really informs that. I love how it grows. It gives us the ability to think and to grow and become more wise. So I would hope that as Christians, I would hope that they would be interested in reading history. I think it helps us from everything. I mean, even contemporary topics, there's a lot of talk about pacifism or even, I know my kids talk a lot about socialism and communism these days, just based on what's in vogue. But I think history is a great antidote to those things, as far as just reading through, understanding why those things happen and what choices previous leaders made and how we can avoid making disastrous choices going forward.
For sure. Yeah. That's been one of the reasons I'm passionate about church history. It's hard in it's hard, and there's an opportunity in pastoral ministry with church history, because I want people in our church to know, even though we're non-denominational, church history. I want them to feel connected to the broader church. And so, like, for example, during the pandemic, I read a book on Calvin's Geneva, and they actually dealt with the Black Plague and, like, did so pastorally. It's like, we're not the first people that have been through this kind of situation with a pandemic. Like, we can learn things, and there's lots of opportunity. We don't have to invent all sorts of random stuff. I mean, we have lots of inventions, and that's neat. But, like, there's a way to do these things that we can pull from this rich history. And I guess the opportunity I discovered was that, and I told my wife about this, a lot of times when I preach, I'll try to have an illustration up front. You want to have, like, something that, like, hey, look, I'm a human. I'm not just going to be up here lecturing you or whatever. We can connect. And I've been ignoring illustrations from church history. I don't know why. I guess people, you know, I thought they may be boring to people. But there's so many illustrations from church history of the lives of the faithful throughout centuries that we can pull from, where people dealt with modern issues that we face today all throughout history. So I think it's really great. I love that you emphasize wisdom in history. That's really cool. One of the things you did mention is regarding pacifism. That was something I was curious to know more about, because I grew up kind of reading. I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church, very patriotic, some might call it nationalistic. And then I went to college, started reading Shane Claiborne, got way into, like, this new monastic stuff, very pacifistic. And then I kind of go to seminary, and I don't know what to do with warfare. I don't know what, like, there's who developed just war theory? One of the theologians developed just war theory. I just
Augustine.
Don't know.
Yeah,
Augustine. So I guess, you know, there's a history in Christianity of pacifism. Some denominations are, like, pacifistic. That's one of their, like, hallmarks. How should Christians, or I guess, can Christians engage in war? And if so, how do we reconcile that with the Sermon on the Mount?
I appreciate you moving quickly to the easy issues so that we can just do a slam dunk on. That's fantastic. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think most of us have a similar journey to you, but you go through these periods where you absorb things and then you read something else and it changes you and go back and forth. I definitely grew up in a family that loved America, and that usually means lots of flags and supporting the troops. Mm-hmm. And that's what you pick up. I mean, your parents are not that simplistic. I mean, the same parents that taught you that America is a beautiful place would have told you that the Vietnam War was a terrible idea, at least a terrible execution. I mean, at the very, very least, just awful. So I think it was always a lot more complex than we actually picked up. But I remember I went through a stage where I studied quite a few Christian authors who were most certainly pacifists, although they would have said activists. They would have said that turning the other cheek is a very positive thing. Pacifist is more of a step back thing. But I, after wrestling with it for years, I think the best statement on it is by C.S. Lewis.
Okay.
And I think it is, like many things in history, the statements are not nearly as powerful as the question. And C.S. Lewis asked, he says, well, he starts with a statement. He says, war is a terrible thing. Mm. But is it the worst thing? Mm. And I think that that's where I'm at. He's writing as Hitler is pushing the boundaries. And right. The country and England is war weary, not interested in another battle. And pacifist societies are everywhere. But I think all of us can think of personal scenarios where we would be violent in defense of someone else, or be violent in a proactive way. In other words, I'm not going to go into examples, but to me, the you asked about the Sermon on the Mount, and I think the Sermon on the Mount and Romans 13 and New Testament imagery and how the Old Testament speaks about warfare should all be considered as a whole.
Okay.
So the Sermon on the Mount is going to be, I think, best applied by individuals in social situations.
Okay.
And I think so I think turning the other cheek, loving your enemy, I think you and I need to practice that on an individual level. Hmm. That God gives the state the power and the authority to defend its citizens. Hmm. I think Romans 13, we can come to that conclusion. Being a soldier is not condemned in Scripture. I think being in a lynch mob is. I think taking justice into your own hands is. But letting the state defend its citizens is not. I think that from Romans 13, New Testament imagery of soldiers, even Ephesians 6, it's used in a, you know, soldier imagery is used in a positive way, 1 Corinthians 16, and of course the Old Testament. Mm. So I think a Christian should make a careful study of what's different between your personal ideas for vengeance and your own, even often personal protection is different than letting the state defend the state.
That makes sense. That's helpful. One of the kind of using a historical example, trying to pull on your history, training. When I think about the Revolutionary War, there's not an established state per se, unless, I mean, they're trying to constitute a new government, but they decide to have warfare. They make war against kind of the governing authority of the land, and they start a revolution. Now, obviously, revolutions are a fascinating historical topic, and that's putting it pretty mildly, considering bloodshed. But there's a difference between the American Revolution and the French Revolution in terms of what they were both trying for, what they were going for in terms of freedom versus kind of this totalitarian secularism. But how do we harmonize what you've posited, which I tend to agree with? How do we harmonize that? Like, how do we make sense looking at the founders, the Revolutionary War, and go, that was a good Christian thing that, or maybe we wouldn't say that. Maybe we would say they made a mistake. How would you kind of look back on that historical example using what you've just described?
Again, thank you for just asking the easy questions. that's one that I think is really helpful to wrestle with, to truly think through, because that I think you can see the founders wrestling with that idea. You can see it in, I think, the first part of the Declaration of Independence, where they are trying to get at the question, what happens when the government that you are under becomes corrupt? Is it ever okay for a Christian to rebel against the government that they are part of? And the answer from the founders was that they're not really representing us. Mm. They're abusing us.
Okay.
And they're not giving us the right. They're not affording us the rights that God has given to us. Mm. Therefore, it is okay for us to step away and say we want to be independent.
Yeah.
And of course, Britain handled that in a very heavy-handed, foolish way. Not sure that George had it all together there at the end, but so I don't know that I necessarily have an answer. I think it would have been very difficult for us to make that choice going back, and there was Americans made different decisions during that time, but I think I will at least grant them that there is a time where you can say this, we want to change our government.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, that obviously has a lot of implications. It's hard almost not to go with modern implications regarding people's interpretation of government lockdowns and that kind of thing, people choosing to open their churches or not. And, but I really enjoyed talking about that because it has a lot of implications, and you mentioned Christians landed in different ways on it even then.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I love about history, is that we tend to make everything very black and white when we initially think about war and different groups, when these were different families, different people, different states, different different lineages that came together with different reasons for coming together. And so it's much more complicated. That doesn't mean it's not worth studying or anything like that. In fact, it should make us more gracious humans today.
Can I say one more thing on that, Chase?
Yeah.
I think one, it's good for us to be students of history. And if an idea has never worked before, we ought to treat it with great caution. So that's what's difficult with the argument for pacifism, for nonviolence, is that it has never worked in human history. Mm. And there have been some notable failures, and some notable failures close to home. So I don't know if it's general knowledge, but Pennsylvania was founded as a pacifist colony.
Okay.
By William Penn, Quaker. Even their constables, even their law enforcement, were only given power to persuade.
Oh, wow.
So basically, stop, or I will say stop again louder, and or I'll get another person to say stop with me.
So like social workers.
Yeah, yeah. People just laughed. And I mean, as long as they were all Quakers, it was fine.
Right.
But you know, when you have a colony that has land, and aggressive people will often flock towards places where there is not strong rule.
Sure.
And that's what happened. And then those aggressive people refused to obey the laws and put Pennsylvania under William Penn in a very difficult situation. I won't go through all of it, but eventually Pennsylvania is forced to hire mercenaries because they didn't believe in forming a militia to defend themselves from marauding Native American tribes. So pacifism just is not effective as a national strategy.
Mm.
The only time it works is if you've got a really strong neighbor that's going to take care of all of your armed forces for you.
Okay.
And you can see that a little bit in Canada's foreign policy. I won't go too far. I love our Canadian neighbors, but it's just it doesn't work on a national level. And people say, well, what about Switzerland? Well, the reason why Switzerland is able to stay neutral in many of these wars is because in a minute they can call up so many trained soldiers. And so they have they've got a steel fist in that velvet glove.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's an interesting leadership kind of parable as well, because anytime, like not just church, but in any kind of leadership situation, let's use family, because church and power is a complicated and longer discussion. But with family, if my kids sense dad's not going to enforce rules, mom's not going to enforce rules, you know, there are no rules, well, there's going to be chaos, you know. And it's like in any leadership scenario, there needs to be appropriate, you would almost say biblical principles that are embodied and lived out in order to honor God's created order for how governing authority works, for how a family works, because that's the way God designed us to be formed and shaped, and how God designed the world to work best. And so I think, going back to your point that pacifism hasn't worked, you know, I think that goes against God's created order to embrace this kind of attitude where, you know, we don't want, not only do we not want to, but we're not going to enforce law, and we're not going to have any kind of authority. We're going to abdicate authority. That's not going to go well for any community, any family. I would say even church, which I know is a different topic, but I think there's some lessons there for leadership in church as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great observations.
One of the topics you researched, and it's I don't know how much you researched it in your PhD, but you've mentioned it already a couple times, is communism. I've been kind of studying it for the last few years. Have people throw around labels as I watch different videos from different speakers and authors, just trying to understand socialism, communism. As someone who grew up in the 90s, you know, I don't remember the Berlin Wall falling. That wasn't part of, I mean, it fell when I was like three, I think, but that wasn't part of my experience. And so I think there's a lot of people my age that didn't grow up, you know, hiding under desks for fear of nuclear war, that didn't go through kind of the McCarthyism, all that kind of stuff. And so I guess just to kind of open the conversation on socialism, communism, maybe what is the relationship between those two terms, those isms, and how do they inform one another?
You know, communism is a how to define it quickly. The best work I think on 20th century communism is called Modern Times by Paul Johnson. It really is fantastic. If you can wade through it, not to be attempted lightly. I mean, the book is huge. It's I don't know, 1,000 pages type thing, but it really lays it out well. And communism is part of a larger trend in 20th century that Johnson describes as relativistic totalitarian utopians. And it's such a great description, because it starts with morals are now relative. And it's a twist. It's a wrong but maybe inevitable result of Einstein's theory of relativity, and people begin to apply it to morals. Marx certainly was going that direction, Freud going that direction, in many ways Nietzsche, but morals are no longer divinely handed down. And you also have this huge power vacuum after World War I. The monarchs are gone, and the empires that are still left have lost their will to create order in the world, and in steps these gangster politicians, the totalitarians, the Lenins, the eventually Stalin, Mao, Pol Pot, or name your dictator in Africa, Latin America. And then the last piece is utopians. So they've gotten rid of God, they've gotten rid of heaven. So they have this, they all have this utopia in mind. And for the communists, it was this workers' paradise. And so you have these relativistic totalitarian utopians. They don't have a universal moral foundation. They operate by forcing you to do what they ask, and even try and control your thoughts. And they're trying to get to paradise. The ends justify the means. And what that means is 10 million, at least under Stalin, 20 to 40 million under Mao. And then you have Pol Pot, another six. Just unbelievable amount of death and destruction. So communism is part of that overall trend in the 20th century to try and get to heaven without God. And the result is just horrific. To me, in contrast to socialism is really more of a a big government idea that a large one size fits all solution is much more effective than giving people freedom, much more safe than giving people freedom. And I think that could be a longer, more difficult conversation.
Okay. That's great. That's really helpful. Cause actually, you'll probably get a laugh out of this. On Sunday, I'm preaching Easter and we're starting a series called Anno Domini, and it's going to be, I'm going to explain it to you. I'm not hopefully going to explain it in my sermon. It's going to be a deconstruction of late modernism and going through seven characteristics of late modernism, and doing so from the Bible, to show how these things happen, how these ideologies came to power, and really not so much to be a lecture series, but to help Christians think biblically about their own lives, because all of us have been kind of incubated in this modern world where we've adopted these principles and these ideologies, even without knowing these attitudes. So like the one on Sunday is going to be materialism and consumerism, and how our modern world is obsessed with the physical reality. There's a disenchantment, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ re-enchants the world. And all of a sudden there's a transcendent order that we have to submit to. And we're going to Acts and talking about how Paul confronts the men of Athens with that reality that, look, you need to turn your eyes heavenward and accept the moral order of things, or kind of else is what he says. And so it's going to be, my point is this is helping me as I continue to try to work out how I'm going to articulate this to be helpful for people and practical, and not just, too heady, you know?
I look forward to listening to that, Chase.
Oh, great. I'll share it with you. have you happened to stumble across Rod Dreher on, I haven't read The Benedict Option. Have you read Live Not by Lies?
Live Not by Lies looks really good. I've read some reviews on it, as well as Benedict Option. So I'm just aware of Rod from a distance.
Okay, cool. We're doing our men's study this spring and summer on Live Not by Lies. So it should make for some lively conversations. One thing that's going to invariably come up in that, and that I'm curious to kind of hear your thoughts on as someone who's studied it and as a pastor, is it fair to say that communism is antithetical to Christianity? Is that putting it too strongly, too mildly? How would you kind of react to that statement?
Yes, I would say antithetical to Christianity. Of course, it depends on your definition. From a 20th century definition, I would say absolutely. They are at odds.
Okay.
But you know, I think most people can confuse those two, communism and socialism. Socialism, not necessarily. Communism is, I mean, really, communism begins with this idea that religion is a farce.
Gotcha.
And so it's really difficult, if that's where you start, to then move on holding hands and working together.
Yeah, for sure. So in your understanding, communism is atheistic.
Yes.
And Marx, is it fair to say it's Marxist wherever it's been tried?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Which
Marxist and not done so well.
Yeah, right. And Marx, when you actually look back on Marx, I mean, this is not to talk about him too much, but he was kind of a terrible person. For all of his big ideas about
as good the Calvinists, world. There's a lot of that going around, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe even us without Jesus.
That's right.
Yeah.
But yeah, can you expand a little bit more, you know, just to educate someone like me and people my age? Obviously communism starts in a bad place, denying that God exists, and operating from an atheistic framework. Religion is kind of the opium of the people. How would you expound further on the reality that communism is antithetical to Christianity?
Well, it goes from saying that religion is a farce and religion is something that just keeps people somewhat numb as people take advantage of them economically, and then moves on to physically try and destroy the church, as in walk up and put a bullet in their head.
Right.
So it's, they don't work well together. it's these communists are, I think, by definition or by practice, totalitarian. Okay. They do not tolerate, they are not interested in a opposing view. And so, and they, in the 20th century, they resort to violence when they are opposed. And so Christianity is a different world. It believes that God is the primary moving factor. Faith is a primary moving factor rather than economics. And they believe that faith is the highest good. And in many ways, communists believe that faith is one of the highest evils, since it's in direct opposition.
Wow. One thing that's fascinating about it is that we all look at the swastika as a symbol of hate and violence and evil. Mm-hmm. And yet there seems to be an affinity in our culture for the hammer and sickle, as if it was almost a noble attempt at utopia.
Yeah.
And that really saddens me. And I don't really know what to do with it other than not let my kids imbibe that kind of worldview. But it's weird how fashionable, whether it's, who was the Cuban guy that did the communist revolution there?
Castro.
Right. Mm-hmm. And other people like him, you'll put him on shirts, you'll find him at Urban Outfitters, whatever it was.
Yeah.
It's weird, man. It's weird. I don't know if it's Gramsci's long march through the institutions that's just coming home at this point. I don't know how to describe our comfort with these symbols of hate and evil in our world. It's very confusing.
Yeah, we're not very good at history, and I think thinking through these things. I would even take it a step further. I get sad when I go into a Mexican restaurant and they've got pictures of the Aztecs and the Aztec temples on the walls. Like, what are we? Why is that on the wall? I mean, it's got, one of them has, you know, blood really running down the steps. They believe that the source of energy for the sun continuing to move was the blood of their victims. And so if they stopped sacrificing, they thought the sun would stop, wouldn't come up again. And so they just were endless human sacrifice. And that stuff is painted on the walls of the Azteca Mexican restaurant. And I like, what are we?
Why?
That's not appetizing, one. And two, it's really evil. And yeah, same with obviously Nazis, but somehow Mao is okay. Yeah. Although easily six times as many people killed by Mao, and it's his own people.
It's crazy.
It's please read a history book.
Right.
and see that's not a good direction. It doesn't go well. And Mao justifies the killing of his own people by saying the revolution is no picnic. So he's not a good person, not someone that we should emulate, and not a form of government that leads to human flourishing.
Right. That makes sense. Kind of last question before I let you go. And like the previous questions, I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on this. Growing up, I in the church, that on the 4th of July, we'd have these big, you know, American flag on stage. We're singing patriotic songs. It was confusing. And then I kind of walked away.
it was confusing.
And then I walked away from that kind of like attitude and had much more of a like, hey, this is not okay. It's bad. And I went over to the mission field, and everyone else in different countries perceives America as a Christian nation, especially Islam. That's where I was, in Islamic dictatorship. They perceive everyone here as Christian. Britney Spears is Christian. Everyone here is a Christian, you know, which was nuts to me as a missionary trying to share the gospel. I'm like, good night. They believe that anyone who wears a cross is a Christian. That's terrifying. And so I've been confused. You know, I've been trying to find clarity. And as someone who's a historian, Is it fair to say, like, how would you describe the relationship? I mean, this is a big topic, but I want to get really specific. Is it fair to say that America was founded on Christian principles? Like, I don't know if I'm comfortable calling America a Christian nation. I just don't know what to do with that at this point in my life, especially with a lot of people decrying what they're calling Christian nationalism. I'm just wondering, as a historian, how have you processed some of those ideas?
Yeah. I really appreciate your questions today. They've all been really good and really hard. I guess I would have preferred, like, what are your three favorite things about Abraham Lincoln? You're really missing softball questions for your Foolproof Theology podcast.
Sorry, Paul.
That's all right. There is no such thing as a Christian nation.
Okay.
I mean, it's, in many ways, it's like calling a church a building. We all do it, but it's not even remotely accurate.
Okay.
Founded on Christian principles. Yeah, sort of. I mean, and definitely a lot of all the founders spoke of God, whether they were deists or Congregationalists or Baptists. And so there's definitely some people doing their best to live out their faith in forming a new country. So they're definitely there. Sometimes they're there in surprising, beautiful ways. Mm. But history is definitely complex. I think what's good for us to do at this point in time is to say, if the effect is lots of flag waving and singing patriotic hymns in church, what's the cause?
Mm.
And I think it's good for us to remember that the cause is the Cold War.
Mm.
In God we trust on our money. That's because of the Cold War. You know, Washington didn't institute that.
Right.
So the Cold War is an ideological battle between capitalists and communists, and more specifically, theistic capitalists against communists. Communists, God doesn't exist. Theistic capitalists, God exists and directs us. Communists, ends justify the means. Theistic capitalists, we believe in God and we believe in the Ten Commandments. Sort of. But,
sure.
You know, it's so the contrast is there. So you can't just take Christian nationalism and believe that it's instituted by Jefferson, Washington, and Lincoln. I think you really need to look at it and say, this was our response to a very real threat. Things like the Pledge of Allegiance, too. You know, things, they come out of this idea of they're influenced by the Cold War.
Mm.
That has now, it doesn't exist anymore.
Mm.
So it makes sense that we would begin to discard it and to unravel it. But it has a real historical cause, and it meant something to my parents' generation, and at least, you know, me through my teen years. It was important. It was necessary. But I think it's okay for us to begin as Christians to maybe strip off many of the excesses of that time period.
For sure. That's really helpful. And I so appreciate your historical kind of understanding and approach to my questions that are a little too on the nose. And I think that it's helpful for Christians to at least explore what you've talked about, you know, in terms of the founding and really avoiding the tribalism that that I think modernity just kind of re-entrenches. We lack freedom and conversation and association just to talk about issues that we disagree on. And so for me, this conversation was really fun. Thanks so much for coming on the show and really making me wiser by sharing some of your experience, your learning. I appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure. It's fun to talk with you. And I hope in many ways that we've inspired people to pick up a history book and learn a little bit of wisdom.
Yeah, that's great. And you referenced Paul Johnson's Modern Times. Is that the one you would recommend for people?
Yeah, if you like a long history book, one that's really good and I think is often picked up in academic settings is The Religious History of America by Gosted and Schmidt.
Okay.
That's another great one to start with. Johnson has a pretty good History of America as well that I think is worth reading. But there's so many great historians out there that that even just checking the Amazon reviews and picking it up is a great way to go.
That's great. Any kind of place, if people wanted to hear more of your teaching, preaching, reading, writing, is there any place people can go to find more of that?
Well, SomaEastside.org is our church, and that's where you can either search that on YouTube or on Google, and you'll find us. I occasionally speak about historical topics. I'm fairly focused on pastoring these days, but I did write a book about World War I called Courage that you can find on Amazon. I traced what it was like to fight in World War I from a common soldier's perspective. So learning about the war from a first-person account.
That's great. Okay, so yeah. People can find that on Amazon. That's awesome. Thanks so much for your time. If you enjoyed this podcast, you're watching on YouTube, watching on Facebook, go ahead and subscribe, click that like button, and leave us a review. Share this with somebody you think would like it or maybe wouldn't like it, and you just want to have a conversation about it, because really, that's really kind of the heart behind the podcast, is to elevate our conversations to be more informed and theologically informed. So next time, hopefully next week, we are, Lord willing, having Mason King from the Village Church in Flower Mound on the podcast to talk about some more Jonathan Edwards. So until then, we'll see you next time.